Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is now 14:40, and so time to resume our afternoon session. Now, briefly, before I hand over to Ms. Powis, who will lead us through the biodiversity, ecology, and natural environment considerations matters at agenda item 8, just an initial check. Is there anybody in the room who is not familiar with the process or has not been in a hearing before? I believe not. I seem to recognise all faces. In fact, there seems to have been such a remarkable clearance of the room that it is essentially now just us and the applicant. Is that correct? Yes, and we have a public gallery with one or two folk who are here but not participating. Okay, so we don't need to do any further introductions of the process or the venue. I also just wanted to refer very briefly to the other item on the agenda that we did foreshadow that we might deal with this afternoon. That's agenda item 7, construction effects at sea and on land. Now, essentially where we're looking at that is that in relation to a sort of prioritisation of issues, we have a considerable number of questions that we want to test on agenda item 8. And even though we know we don't have Natural England here, or the MMO, who would have been quite useful participants in that conversation. Nevertheless, they're matters that include things that we believe we need to explore orally with the applicant. So we're proposing to lead with those. Whereas when we review item 7, essentially, because there's nobody else here who desperately wants to talk about it to us, we would be prepared to defer anything remaining there, subject to time, into EXQ3.
Scott Lanish for the applicant. That's extremely helpful. So we anticipated, given the absence of any interest on agenda item 7 from other parties in particular, that might be the appropriate course, and we would welcome that. We noted as well from the existing second round of questions that there were a few written questions posed in there, which might fall under this agenda item as well. So. Your comment comes as no surprise to us, and we welcome them, sir. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, let's let's do that. So we'll go straight then. We'll cut to the chase. We'll go to agenda item 8, and Ms. Powis will lead that item.
Thank you. Before we start, could I just ask for a run around the table just for my record so that I know who we've got here?
Scott Linus, barrister again for the applicant.
Thank you.
Sean Leake, Gobi Consultants for the applicant.
Thank you.
Sally Kayser, Gobi Consultants for the applicant.
Sean Sweeney, APM Limited for the applicant on option.
Jennifer Holgate from Womblebond Dickinson for the applicant.
Actually, could we just come back one, because I'm not sure that...
Did you cap me?
Yes. Sir, sorry.
Okay. Sorry, Sean Sweeney from APM Limited, representing the applicant on offshore ornithology.
Thank you very much. I think it worked that time.
Sammy Mullen, Gobi Consultants for the applicant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. As Mr. Smith's already mentioned, we don't have Natural England here, we don't have the MMO and Kent Wildlife Trust here, which is an observation capacity today. So we're proposing to take the same approach that we took at ISH3, in the sense that actions that might arise today, or matters that may arise today that we could do with the views of those parties on, we would like to put those into action points. With the deadline of D5, and that would be an efficient way of capturing comments as the parties that may have views on those matters as efficiently as possible, as long as the applicant is content with that approach.
Scott Lanish, the applicant, entirely. Thank you.
What I will also foreshadow that we will try and do is, because we know we're working to that rubric now. Sorry, sir.
Sean Leake for the applicant. The only slight hesitancy on deadline 5 is that we're trying to arrange a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with Natural England, to just close out some of these final matters in the Statement of Common Ground.
Yeah.
So we have some agreed positions today that I can update you on.
Okay.
And there's just a little uncertainty on the date, in part because Natural England have asked for a meeting that doesn't get in the way of deadline 5, so we're just balancing that slightly.
Okay.
Certainly with a view to a well-established final Statement of Common Ground for deadline 6, obviously, but that's the only... slight hesitancy.
Fine. And as ever, if there are matters that the action points address that can actually be captured in statements of common ground, then all the better from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So sounds good.
Just before we continue, I did just want to observe that because we know we're doing this process, unlike last time when we kind of didn't and had to make it up, what we will try to do is minimise the necessity for MMO and Natural England to need to go to the oral record. So we'll try and capture issues as fully as we can in the written process, in the action list. Okay.
And just to follow up on that point about your further meetings with Natural England, obviously what we're now looking at is, well, the importance of D5 to us is that we need to take everything from that to feed into the report to inform, you know, the report on implications for European sites, which comes out on the 14th of May. So by that point, we need to have as much information as possible in order to make the consultation on that as helpful as possible. Can I start, before we delve into what we've got there on the agenda, can I just start with a quick one on the structures exclusion zone? I know we've heard a lot about it this morning, but I just wanted to quickly touch on the screening exercise that's been undertaken in terms of the environmental statement and the RIA. Could you just briefly explain to me what discussion, if any, you've had with the kind of statutory advisors like Natural England, MMO, in drawing those screening conclusions, what needs further assessment and what's screened out?
Absolutely. Sean Leake for the applicant. We had, as we started to introduce the, or as we introduced the SEZ, we had an initial discussion with both Natural England and MMO, MMO for slightly different reasons in relation to the disposal sites, but certainly with Natural England, introduced the SEZ and noted that it may be beneficial for some of the discussions with regards to the Outer Thames Estuary, SPA in particular. Mm-hmm. And we identified that in general terms, but certainly for environmental or ecological factors, you would anticipate that it would be a benefit. It's a reduction in the overall area, noting that the maximum parameters, wind turbine numbers and so on, obviously remain the same. That was noted and welcomed by Natural England. The most recent statement of common ground before the panel at the moment reflects the evolution of that, I think, that position. We then went through the remainder of the environmental statement, agreed that, and I suppose for us, most importantly, spoke with Natural England to just determine whether or not a full report to inform appropriate assessment reiteration should be undertaken or whether they would be happy with an addendum. Mm-hmm. They said they didn't mind particularly either way, but noted that an addendum does keep the overall page count down and should be able to address the pertinent points, really. So that's been the sort of the key discussions, really, with regards to MMO. Again, it relates to the disposal sites in particular, and just the delineation of them, as you'll remember, we had an issue with the polo-shaped disposal site, which can't go through the system, so we've obviously restructured that.
So as far as you're aware, you wouldn't expect any disagreement from those parties now about your screening exercise?
No. Sorry, Sean Leake for the applicant. No, we haven't had any disagreement with them at all. There are just the matters that identified on the agenda, actually, that are still under discussion, but certainly the screening exercise has been received positively so far. Okay. We had communication from the MMO this morning on some clarifications, and that wasn't amongst them.
Okay. Can I just ask, as a general point of interest, just looking at the documentation you put in on this, obviously what we were looking at as a result of this SEZ is a smaller area for the same number of turbines, which means a higher density of turbines within, on that site. To what extent has that featured in your considerations of screening in and out things for the ES or the RIA?
Sean Leake for the applicant. It was certainly a consideration for the core topic areas that had annexes submitted as part of that exercise, really. With regards to the other parameters, if I can put it like that, the minimum spacing, for example, remains the same.
Yeah.
So for some of those other key receptors, commercial fishing and so on, The minimum spacing remains the same, but the potential area of interaction reduces. Yeah. So it's sort of, we'll probably discuss it later on this evening, but there's if there's a sliding scale of magnitude in some respect, then we're sort of at the lower end without fundamental change. With regards the other parameters, ecologically, it doesn't make a significant difference apart from increasing the distance from the designated site or from one of the designated sites. The overall swept area for ornithological considerations, for example, stays the same. The overall footprint for benthic ecology and fish and shellfish remains the same, overall lengths of cables and so on.
And
so whilst it might be in a slightly denser area,
yeah, I mean, so that's one area that occurred to me was the benthic ecology and fish and shellfish density.
I mean, it's the, I suppose the overall, the footprint remains the same, but it might be in a slightly smaller area. Mm. The next
it's a higher percentage of a smaller area.
Smaller area, absolutely. And the percentage of those habitats is considered both within a study area and then at a wider regional basis to understand whether there'd be a loss of a particular habitat, the most sensitive of which is the Sabularia spinulosa habitat, which has the ability to form biogenic reefs under some circumstances. And the mitigation in place for that has been, the main mitigation of micro-siting has been well established across a number of these projects and wider industries. For this project in particular, given the backgrounds of the existing Thanet wind farm that's been recognised as, certainly through the monitoring reports, is actually having a beneficial effect and the reef seems to have increased its footprint. The mitigation is slightly more nuanced in that we'd be seeking to micro-site around areas of core reef rather than every reef, but fundamentally immaterial of where they are, we would be seeking to avoid the sensitive habitat.
I mean, can I just follow that one up very briefly? In that, clearly, not to a substantial extent, because you know, at the end of the day, the percentage order of change is not that high. But you are clear that you haven't reached a point where your capacity to microsite to avoid relevant habitats has not been essentially completely removed in relation to some that you might otherwise wish to have flexibility around.
Sean Leake for the applicant. Yes, sir. It's been a consideration. A review was undertaken of the spatial extent of the array to look for potential sensitive habitats, and there's still sufficient space for micro-siting, either in an ecological sense or indeed for archaeology. Obviously, the micro-siting is a consideration as well.
Yeah. Okay. I think then I'm happy to move on to the first item on our agenda, item A. on offshore ornithology. You've touched on this already, so it was a point of clarification, really, but the Statement of Common Ground offshore ornithology that we've had the most recent deadline, can I be comfortable that the entire document takes account of the structures exclusion zone? It mentions it in relation just to the red-throated diver, but can we work on the basis that it does?
Scotland has happened. Yes, it does, ma'am.
So what I would propose we do then is quickly look at a couple of these species and sites where we, at last documented position, at least we had some disagreements still. So shall we start then with the red-throated diver of the Outer Thames estuary? So we've met at ISH 3 and we explored the differences a bit between the parties on the in combination effects on the red-throated diver. There seems to have been a fair amount of work done in the interim, but ultimately we still are in a position where we have Natural England telling us that they can't conclude no adverse effect on integrity when we look at in combination effects. And there's a fairly nuanced now comment in the latest Statement of Common Ground, and I get the sense that we're basically getting as far as we're going to get with Natural England on this. I think the latest comment, I will read it out because they're not here. They're saying, following the introduction of the SCZ, we acknowledge that there is now some uncertainty whether there would be any displacement effects given the distance from the project. The project is now planned to be from the SPA. However, it cannot be concluded that there will be no displacement effect at all. So I suppose my first question is, do you have any update on the position since that latest Statement of Common Ground?
Scott Lannis for the applicant. In a word, ma'am, no. Perhaps I could explain our position. That's the latest statement of position from from Natural England. Obviously, with the SEZ, we've looked at this again, and the relevant effect, as you've identified, is displacement. And one of the things we've been trying to work out is the basis for Natural England saying that there would be an adverse effect in combination. And one point that we have set out in our deadline for documentation, Appendix 19, is that we've looked at the in combination assessment work undertaken for red-throated diver. We've identified that all preceding wind farm projects that were included in the in combination assessment for Thanet Extension, for which a project-specific HRA has been undertaken, concluded no adverse effect on integrity. Mm-hmm. And when one combines that with the fact that, particularly following the SEZ, the revised distance between the Thanet Extension and the SPA is 7.65 kilometres, so that's within a 5% margin of the maximum distance the Natural England has identified that red-throated divers may show displacement. So at that distance, the scale of any displacement effect will certainly not be 100%. And as far as we are concerned, it can be stated to be essentially 0% or very, very close to it. Mm. So in those circumstances, we have combined that with the view that all of the in combination projects included in the assessment have been found to cause no adverse effect on integrity, and concluded that as a result we should not be regarded as having an adverse effect on integrity on an in combination basis, particularly because of the distances involved. There's simply, you know, virtually 0% displacement, and that would remain our view. And whilst Natural England aren't here to explain their position, I think reading between the words in that statement, I mean, they've accepted that there's some uncertainty whether there'd be any displacement effects at all, and essentially that's our point. We just don't think there would be any displacement effects, particularly following the SEZ. So that's our position on red-throated diver, ma'am.
Thank you. I think my feeling is, from what we've seen so far, I mean, we will obviously be asking Mr. Natural England as a follow-up action anyway, because they haven't had a chance to respond in writing to any of the SEZ stuff, actually. So deadline 5 is the first time that we'll see their full position, other than what's been in that statement of common ground, which you helpfully submitted last week. But obviously, we find ourselves in a position, if this is where we're going to be, I mean, I don't know, do you plan any further work, or is this the position that we're going to be at by the end of examination?
I can hand over to Sean Leake for the applicant. Mm. I can hand over to Sean Sweeney, the ornithological lead.
Thank you.
But in short, certainly for red-throated diver at the Outer Thames Estuary, I think we are at the limit of what further sort of information we'll get from Natural England on it, really. I mean, I'll hand over to Sean in particular, because there's some nuances about the buffers in particular. But.
Okay.
Yeah, Sean Sweeney for the applicant. Yeah, I mean, I can confirm that, I mean, the work that we've done to date in terms of the assessment of previous consents, then on the assessment of the potential for in combination of other projects and any contribution from Thanet Extension and the structural exclusion zone with that incorporated, it did now bring the contribution down to being beyond, you know, small. And so we feel that there is no real further work that could be done on this, because we have effectively provided enough evidence to suggest that there is no potential for effect from an extension on the Outer Thames Estuary SPA population.
Setting aside further work, I mean, it's still work, but it's work of a different nature, and that is essentially the ongoing dialogue with Natural England through the Common Ground process and or around, you know, their thought processes leading them up to their submission at deadline 5, is there any prospect of a further conversation that clarifies matters to a point where they actually might even agree that there would not be any relevant displacement effects? It strikes me as that it's, you know, given the position that you have articulated, I kind of understand why you're saying you can't do any more work. But I'm not clear that the logic is clear if Natural England's position
doesn't maybe shift one stop further along the dial to recognise the position post SEZ in a way that maybe, and that they need to think through the SEZ materials.
Yeah. Scott Lannard for the applicant. Sir, yes, it's not entirely clear to us why they are still saying that there would be an adverse effect on integrity when you take into account the combination of the points I've addressed. So, yes, we will go back to them and try and understand what the basis, if any, is for any outstanding objection.
I wonder, is that a point worth putting specifically in the action list that we are then asking the applicant to make the additional telephone call or whatever on that point? Sufficiently before deadline five, so that if it's capable of being swept up by deadline five, that then happens, and that's an issue that can be ticked off the list.
Okay. Sir, Scott Lannard for the applicant. Sir, yes. I mean, one thing we may do is just try and confirm, for example, the contribution that's being made as a prelude to any further discussions.
Thank you. I suppose in the absence of agreement, if we find ourselves basically in this same position by the time we get to the end of examination, we have to, as a panel, consider how we're recommending to the Secretary of State. And on that basis, I feel it's necessary to ask you, really, if the Secretary of State, as the competent authority, was minded to conclude that there was an adverse effect, or that they couldn't conclude against an adverse effect, what alternative solutions and compensatory measures have been considered, or what is the is there a need to proceed beyond stage two of the HRA process to consider those steps? It's not something I'm asking you to answer now, but it is something that is in our minds as we are 6 weeks from the end, slightly more, of examination. How do we report on matters like this? Because it leaves us in quite a tricky position. And this is a comment to you and to Natural England. So it's something that we will also include in that action list. I would like to invite your written submissions on that.
Scott Lannard for the applicant. Yes, ma'am, thank you. It's a point that hadn't escaped our notice. I think at this stage, we haven't advanced that case, as you are aware, because at the moment we say that although you have this view of the Statutory Nature Conservation body, as a matter of law, you don't have to follow it, albeit you have to give it weight unless there's a reason to depart from it. I think our proposition would be that we haven't seen any cogent explanation for Natural England maintaining their position in the light of the points that I've put to you. So we would say, as a matter of law, there's absolutely no issue in you following our approach, notwithstanding the advice that's been given by Natural England. But we will take on board the comment you've just made.
Thank you. Okay, then, if you're happy, we'll move on to look at Flamborough and Filey Coast SPA. Before we start talking about Kittiwake, I just have a nagging feeling that I'm not sure we have it documented, the conclusions in respect of Gannet. So I just wanted to ask whether it's possible to confirm that we have this agreement of project loan and in combination, no adverse effect on Gannet.
Sean Sweeney for the applicant. Yes, I can confirm that Natural England did agree that this project would not be the cause of an adverse effect of integrity for the Outer Thames Estuary. Flamborough and Filey Coast SPA for Gannet.
Thank you. Yes. Could I ask that the next iteration of the offshore ornithology statement of common ground just documents that, because as it stands, it's not kind of expressly put in there. So just to include a line to say that would be really helpful.
Sean, so you for the applicant. Yes, no problem.
Thank you. Okay, and then moving on to the Kittiwake, as far as the latest documented position is, we still have disagreement on the in combination effects for Kittiwake on the collision front. I'll start by inviting any update from the applicant on this as well, please.
Scott Lennon for the applicant. Ma'am, very happy to do that. Just before I do, I wonder if I ask, would you mind speaking a little bit closer to the microphone?
Yeah,
just the acoustics in this room, some are struggling to pick. Thank you very much. Yes, as you're aware, at the latest Statement of Common Ground stage, the Natural England position was that the collision risk modelling assessments based on either party's methods and effects or parameters used made no material difference to the overall conclusions. And although Natural England appeared to be maintaining a similar position to that in relation to the red-throated diver, they seem to accept that any contribution that would be made by this scheme wouldn't make any material difference to any in combination assessment. Now, the context for this is that we set out our position at both deadline 3 and deadline 4. And the results of our in combination assessment identified that the contribution of the Thanet extension alone to the population of the SPA was annually between 0.6 and 1 kittiwake mortality.
Yes.
And sorry, sir.
Yeah, I have a particular question on that very point, which right. It may be appropriate to deal with actually now. Your consent must pass. And this is a point that we need to capture in the action list and revert back to Natural England on, because it's oddly akin to some of the conversations that we were having about elements of mathematical modelling approach in relation to navigation risk assessment, which is oddly that if you end up using mathematical modelling approaches and you reach conclusions about very fine numbers of individuals or very, very small fractions of risk, in circumstances where essentially the statistical validity of your approach has run out, because if you are making a conclusion about population scales, then you can draw valid, you can perform tests that demonstrate that you're drawing reasonably valid conclusion statistically, but if you're reaching conclusions about point something of a bird or one bird, proposition that in relation to the quality and the quantity of the data that you've input into the model, you are maybe in a place where you are drawing conclusions that are beneath the valid operating parameters of the model, if that makes sense. I do not claim any particular expertise around this, but I do have a running concern that there have been occasions. This is not the first offshore wind farm where this point has arisen. It's arisen in several cases where essentially Natural England have come to the table making points about potential reservations around adverse effect on integrity on effects that do amount to, say, in combination, point something of a bird or one bird. And I think it's fair to say that certainly I have a reservation about the scientific credibility of that and the statistical validity of that as a position, and that in circumstances where we need to be clear about what the legal consequence of an adverse effect on integrity is and escalation in the HRA tree, that it would actually, if things are not are beneath the resolution of the model and not capable of actually being dealt with in a clear recommendation from a modelling exercise, then I guess my request to Natural England in those terms would be to be frank about that and to be then much clearer and much more robust that conclusions at larger population scales are absolutely valid and very robust, but that we're not going to try and say that there's an adverse effect on integrity once we've ceased to be able to speak about genuine population scale effects.
Yes. I mean, I'll ask Scott Lanners for the applicant. I'll ask Mr. Sweeney to comment on that central proposition, beyond noting that the range that I've identified is in part through considering what Natural England considered a more precautionary scenario to modelling. But I wonder if Mr. Sweeney could just deal with that point about the reliability of modelling when you essentially have results that are this low as far as mortality is concerned, and then I'll come back and put that in the wider context of other work.
Yes, Sean Sweeney for the applicant, yes. I mean, in terms of a general point, for, say, for instance, PVA modelling, then the contribution of, or the difference of the trajectory over 35 years of adding or subtracting one bird from that estimation on the population trajectory would have no consequence to the health of or conservation objectives, for instance, of this particular colony, if it was one bird or 0.6 birds or 1.2 birds.
Can I just briefly interject there? I mean, I think what might help this dialogue, and I'm conscious of the fact that I'm possibly pursuing something that has implications beyond just this case, but if when you do have conversations with Natural England, you're able to ask them if there's any agreement at all about, you know, in relation to a particular species and a particular site, if we were taking you know, Kittiwake of Flamborough and Fylde Coast SPA as a case, how many birds would you need to be dealing with before you actually did start to say, yes, clearly we have a population effect? Because if that number is 20, 30, 40, then 1, 0 point something, is nowhere near.
Short for the applicant, we have, in fact, raised this point with Natural England on a number of occasions as to what the number may be that they would see fit to be the threshold. We've not had that number presented to us as of yet, but we are aware of additional modelling put forward for the Norfolk Vanguard project recently, and there was a revision to the original PVA model for Kittiwake for the Flamborough and Fylde Coast SPA. The original one was actually submitted for Hornsey 2 project, and it was updated by the consultants MacArthur Green for Hornsey Project 3, who are the consultants for Norfolk Vanguard as well, and then it was reapplied for that project. And they have then extended one of the issues in Hornsey 2 under the PVA was that it wasn't projected for the life of the project, so it was extended to 35 years, including all the projects that have been consented to date and in the planning process. So it also includes Hornsey 3, Norfolk Vanguard and Stanley Extension's minimal contribution. And the trajectory over the 35 years does actually point towards the fact that the conservation objectives for the Flamborough and Fylde Coast SPA would still be met with all three projects at the more precautionary rates of collision risk following the parameters advocated by Natural England.
Is there anything, it's just occurring to me, emerging from work like additional modelling on Vanguard that's live in examination that's not currently part of our examination? Is it worth asking you to bring anything of relevance into our examination?
Scott Lyons for the applicant. Ma'am, yes. If I can just deal with this way, we'll obviously start with the basis of the low number of annual Kittiwake mortalities that we've identified. But we're aware that through the Norfolk Vanguard process, these sorts of figures have been inputted into population modelling, which is being carried out as part of that examination. And before one gets to that, I just need to raise one point, which is that as far as the Natural England approach to adverse effect on integrity is concerned, we understand that there, as with the red-throated diver, they have reached a position that is based on the adverse effect in combination of existing consented schemes. So the same point we made about red-throated diver applies to this element of the in combination assessment. And it's also worth bearing in mind that in combination assessment builds in turbine numbers for several projects where there have been reductions since.
Yep.
So quite apart from the fact that these consented schemes have been assessed as not involving any adverse effect on integrity, for example, there have been reductions at Triton Knoll, which would create, for want of a better word, some headroom or capacity in any event. So, but to return to your point about Norfolk Vanguard, there's been a note that's been prepared for Norfolk Vanguard, which presented an updated assessment recently of the potential impacts on Kittiwake connected to the SPA. And I'll ask Mr. Sasweeney to explain that in a little bit more detail. But in short, the in-combination collision risk assessed there involved an increase in background mortality overall of between 1.8 with Hornsea 3, 1.3 without it. That's then been fed into some population modelling, and in very short order, this involved a slight reduction in growth rate in population of 0.1% and 0%, depending on whether Hornsea Project 3 was included or not. So on the basis of the population model predictions that have been carried out as part of that work, the conclusion is that the number of predicted in-combination Kittiwake collisions is not at a level that would trigger a risk of population decline. So moving beyond the point about individual numbers of fatalities, once you feed that into the model, essentially it might involve a very, very slight reduction in growth rate, but it wouldn't involve a risk of population decline. So regardless of the issue over the small number of mortalities, when you feed it into the next stage of the process, you avoid an in-combination adverse effect on integrity in any event. So that's a very basic summary. Mr. Sweeney can elaborate as necessary, but we'd propose to put that material before this examination as well to inform your consideration of this issue.
Is that currently at the status of being something prepared by the applicant, and is it agreed with Natural England?
I don't think it's formally agreed with Natural England, but as I understand it, the work is being done in consultation with Natural England.
So again, if you are going to put that forward to us, obviously it's a movable feast, but let us know exactly what the status of agreement is.
Scott Lynas, the applicant, of course. Matt, would it help you for Mr. Sweeney just explain his understanding of the position?
Thank you. Sean Sweeney for the applicant. In terms of the position for what Natural England with that project are we talking about?
Sorry,
thanks for clarifying. Yes, I mean, we understand that Natural England and the RSPB partook in consultation with the applicant for Norfolk Vanguard and the consultant McArthur Green to compile amendments to the PVA that's been applied to the Kittiwake population of Flamborough and Farley Coast SPA, and that was in part to update it for Hornsea 3 and then apply that for Norfolk Vanguard as well. As it is a very recent submission to Norfolk Vanguard, I mean, we appreciate there are ongoing concerns between Natural England and the applicant for Hornsea 3, which relate to different matters. But for Norfolk Vanguard, there are, as it is a very recent submission, there has not been a response from Natural England that I know of to date that's on the PINS website. So we will look out for that. And in fact, we're quite willing to make contact with the consultants and try to fathom the opinion to date.
Thank you. And as time goes on in our examination, if things change on that front and you're able to update us, then that would be useful just to bear in mind that we cannot have regard to things that are happening, you know, that aren't submitted into our examination. So we do need to take that step, even though it's next to our project on the website. We can't necessarily taking account of it.
Yes, I mean, it does sound a bit silly for those that don't quite appreciate how the system works, but, essentially, unless everybody in an examination has a clear and shared understanding of what is in, there is a risk of essentially unfairness to parties and also parties not commenting on material that they may need to comment on.
Yes, Scott Lynas for the applicant. So we entirely understand that. The objective will be to ensure that the information that is before this examination is stand alone in that sense and doesn't require you to go to another part of the examination's website.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So just a couple more questions to follow up on Kittiwake. You've referred to that paper, which was, I think, Appendix 25 to your D4 submission. There's a couple of bits in there I quite appreciate just a little bit of clarification on, or a bit of explanation on. You talked in there about the anticipated decommissioning of two projects Beatrice and, or Beatrice the demonstrator and Blythe, which would, in effect, you say, offset the 0.6 kitty wake that could be attributed to Thanet extension. I just wanted to know whether you can provide some certainty about, when you say it's an anticipated decommissioning, what the timescales are and what the certainty is that they are due to be decommissioned.
Sally Casey, for the applicant, can't remember which way around they are. One of them is being decommissioned, one of them, the paperwork is being prepared, from my understanding, in anticipation of it, was the wording that they provided. It was anticipated to be decommissioned, but it's not a formal thing at present. So one, I think, is formally going through the process that Blythe. I've got them the right way around. You've got the document. Sorry, I can't remember which way around the two of them are. I apologise.
I think it's the beginning of table one. Yeah, there they are.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Blythe, that the paperwork is all there, and that's fully expected. Another one, it's initial paperwork that's available for its anticipated decommissioning.
Yeah. Okay. And so, in terms of timescales, are you able to provide an indication?
No. Okay. Afraid not. Okay. I could double check for you, but I don't have the timescales with me.
Okay. It would be helpful if you wouldn't mind as an action point
course.
To follow up on that. So,
yes.
Basically, just so that we know what level of certainty we can put upon that assertion that those two are due to be commissioned. Thank you.
Okay.
I think the only other part of that document then was para 22, when there's a list of documents referred to as new evidence indicating there's been a sort of over-precautionary approach taken to get us in a position that's kind of brought us to where we are. I just wondered if you would mind elaborating on that point. So you've mentioned a number of reports there that have happened in more recent times. Would you be able to provide any more detail on that?
Sean Sweeney for the applicant. Are we referring to the Crown Estate's Headroom report?
Yeah, and then I think there's three more reports on the following page. It's really about to what extent does this new evidence sort of demonstrate that an over-proportionary approach has been taken in assessments to date?
Scott Lanner for the applicant. Ma'am, yes, we can provide a note as part of another action point to explain that.
Okay. Thank you. I don't think I'm going to get into any more detail on Kitty Wake other than to say the same thing that I've said in relation to Red Rota Diver, which is if we get to the end of examination with the position as it is, then we need to, we basically need your views on why we shouldn't be proceeding to stage two of the HRA process. And that again is a question that we'll put in our action list to Natural England. And the reason for doing this is as much it's in everybody's interest basically to have this documented. Okay. The next item then on our agenda is about the in-principle monitoring plan. Just a couple of questions on this, if I may. I can see that the current draft is still looks like it's still undergoing discussion. Have you got an update? It looks like you might have an update on. No.
Apologies. Sean Leake for the applicant. No, we're just discussing because it's something that Sean and I both pick up.
Okay.
Between ourselves on Natural England,
okay,
so I think he was going to answer your question. Apologies.
Fine, that's okay. The schedule of monitoring then that we've had most recently submitted indicates that the in-principle monitoring plan for offshore ornithology will be secured in the DCO, or I think in the DMLs, but the latest version of the DCO that we've got doesn't secure it anywhere. So I've just asked for an update as to how or where this is going to be secured in the DCO.
Sean Leake for the applicant. It will be secured within the respective DMLs.
DML.
Would be the anticipation. It didn't make it into the last iteration of the DCO, but it is in readiness for the next iteration.
I'm presuming just for the generation assets DML, just for the one that affects the turbine, although that's maybe not.
It's an interesting question. It could. Because its focus is purely on red-throated diver, and therefore catches potentially the offshore substation, would be the only reason that it might sit across both.
Okay. Yeah.
There is certainly the last discussion that we had. There's consideration of it sitting across both.
Okay. All right.
For those reasons, yeah.
So can we expect that in the next iteration of the DCO, we'll see it secured in the DML?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So we've had comments from Natural England, and we've had your response to those comments, I think, now for the next last couple of rounds of questions and deadlines. Where are we now? Are you intending to address some of the comments raised by Natural England any further, or are you planning to submit a further iteration of the plan?
Sean Leake for the applicant. The last discussion that we had with Natural England was really just sort of clarification that the concern raised was that by having the option to undertake strategic studies or site-specific, that there could in some way not be an outcome. So effectively reserving a position until such time as that there wouldn't be any sort of study. We obviously made a clarification on the teleconference with them that the applicant's position is very much on committing to do something, and validation of this outer Thames estuary or red-throated diver displacement has always been the focus that any offshore ornithological monitoring would take, because, as we've discussed, it's very low numbers of individuals, and we're now at a point where we're potentially displacing half a bird, depending which end of the bird gets displaced. There is a question over where the statistical, go back to your comments on sort of the statistical validity, there becomes a point at which a study has very little statistical power to detect any change, and there's a question over that. Now, you can overcome that in some way, and a site-specific study may have value, and the applicant is happy to consider that. These things tend to evolve. Considerations for offshore ornithology broadly tend to evolve, and there are suggestions of strategic studies that may contribute more meaningfully towards our understanding of impacts from offshore wind generally, and having the opportunity for either or seems to make sense. That's the position. Natural England have expressed their preference for site-specific, and that is maintained. I don't, at the current point, think that it will evolve beyond that, apart from we're looking at having a further statement within the Statement of Common Ground that says that one of these will be carried through, so that they have that certainty.
Okay. And so the power analysis that they've suggested could be undertaken, that's not something you're planning to take forward?
Not at this point, no. No. I mean, that would inform the final design and layout and the final positions of these turbines if they're such that, for whatever reason, actually this remaining 300 metres or so that is between us and this 8-kilometre sort of magic marker, if there's a position there that suddenly we're beyond any concerns, then I think that would need to be revisited at that point and the surveys considered.
Okay. I'm mindful that a lot of discussion happens between yourselves and Natural England that doesn't necessarily make it into the examination, so forgive me. But in Natural England's earlier submissions, they said there were two areas that they wanted to be covered by this IPMP, and the first was the red-throated diver displacement. The second was about in relation to the Kittiwake and flight heights, I think. Has that fallen away now? I haven't seen anything else coming from them on that, but originally they were saying those were both items they wanted to be covered by that monitoring plan.
The Sean Leake for the applicant. The discussions have all been around this red-throated diver and whether to have strategic or site-specific. To be honest, the Natural England haven't expressed any further request for other offshore ornithological monitoring in that context.
Do then need to get that kind of capped off.
And just finally, on the red-throated diver stuff, and obviously picking up what we were discussing earlier, is there any prospect of anything that's agreed through the IPMP process of helping toward Natural England's views on adverse effects? Am I clutching at straws?
Sean Leake, the applicant. I don't think so. We can certainly talk to them. We are having ongoing dialogue with them. We're trying to arrange this face-to-face meeting, as I say, which is slightly tricky around deadline 5. And we can certainly talk to that. I couldn't give you a robust answer. Apologies.
Okay. Just a couple, then moving on to the fourth part of this agenda item, a couple of other ornithological things. Just to quickly pick up, I remember when we met last, we talked about you consulting Scottish Natural Heritage about St Abstath Bars Castle. SPA. Is there any update on that? I haven't seen.
Sally Kayser for the applicant. We contacted SNH directly to a member that I know has been involved in other offshore wind farm projects. Okay. We heard nothing back, and we chased them up about 2 weeks ago, and we haven't had a response yet.
Okay. It's possible that if there's still no response, then when it comes to publication of the REIS, that it may be sort of flagged in there. And it's, I know there is precedent for us also writing to them at that stage, but we'll see where we are.
Okay.
The only other ones I've got on here on my list and then and are Thanet Coast and Sandwich Bay SPA and the Thanet Coast and Sandwich Bay Ramsar, and that is purely on the salt marsh front. So what I'm proposing to do is that we actually deal with that under item D of our agenda. I mean, I'm not, my records suggest that we've got agreement here, but obviously salt marsh being in supporting habitat for the Ramsar, there's a couple of questions that I think sort of do tie back in. So item D is salt marsh, is that?
Yeah, intertidal salt marsh habitats, 8D is just at the very bottom of the screen.
One question I do have about the SPA, so Thanet Coast and Sandwich Bay SPA, from what I've seen documented in your submissions, this is not an SPA where salt marsh is a supporting feature, not identified as a supporting feature. So, however, we have Natural England saying that their agreement is contingent on the salt marsh mitigation, etc. plan. Can you explain to me why that is their position, just kind of a matter of fact?
Sean Leake for the applicant. I think it feels like this may be a slight relict issue in part from option two.
Okay.
But I think there are some slightly conflicting documents with regards to the SPA as to whether or not it's a supporting habitat or not.
Okay.
Fundamentally. So and when you then start, so if you have two documents saying slightly different things and then look into the ecology of the species in particular, and then the salt marsh at the upper intertidal here that's quite tall sort of grasses, it would indicate that it's not specifically supporting habitat. But as I say, I think it's kind of fallen by the wayside slightly, become slightly moot because of the matter of option two, landfall option two having been dropped.
Yeah. Okay, all right, thank you. Okay, then if you're content, we'll move on to marine mammals. And I don't have an awful lot under this area. Actually, before we move on, sorry. I have noticed in the most recent version of the DCO, in fact, I think it was the D4 version, the introduction of some new DML requirements about ringed plover. And I'm just, I can't find an explanation for this. And I appreciate we don't have a updated explanatory memorandum or anything, but in terms of track changes, it's quite clear that they are new additions. I think we've got DML condition 13, so that committing to a pre-construction survey and also a mitigation plan. So I was really asking for an explanation as to why that's appeared and
yes.
What the relevance is, if any, to the HRA, because as far as I can tell, there isn't.
Sean Leake for the applicant. It is captured within the environmental statement and had made its way into a schedule of mitigation, but not all the way through. And it was when going through the schedule of monitoring, as requested by yourselves, the examining authority, that it fed through into the DCO and is effectively through an audit.
It
decided it needed to be secured all the way through rather than just a commitment within the environmental statement.
Fine, so that's it as a feature of the SSSI probably will. So there is no relevance to HRA conclusions. Excellent. So then we can move on to marine mammals. The main point here being the Southern North Sea SAC and Harbour Porpoise. Do we have any update? Does the applicant have any update on the position? Obviously, the main point here being about the site integrity plan, which is the last document. Obviously, we don't have a more updated statement of common ground on these matters because the recent one only covered offshore ornithology. So I do feel like we're probably lagging behind progress of what's actually happened here. Is there an update?
Sally Kayser for the applicant. Yes, we've basically reached agreement, apart which to do with the SIP is pending sign off. So we, yeah, the updated draft SIP was provided at deadline 4.
Okay.
And yeah, we're waiting to hear whether that satisfies the outstanding questions that they had. I mean, in Natural England's response at deadline 3, they were quite clear they had no major issues with the SIP, but they did have some questions about timing, what happened when.
Coordination of
yes.
the sort of bigger questions than just this project.
Yes. Which we've responded to at deadline 4 and updated the SIP accordingly.
Yeah.
And waiting for feedback on that.
So do you what do you consider the position to be then in terms of agreement on adverse effects for this SAC?
That we have concluded no adverse effect alone and in combination subject to the site integrity plan.
Okay. And so we are at the point where that site integrity plan does need to still be agreed.
Yes.
With Natural England. And will the next statement of common ground capture that?
I will make a note to make sure it does, yes.
Yeah, I think it would be useful because, again, as it stands, I think it is quite contingent. Natural England's agreement is quite contingent on that site integrity plan. And I do totally appreciate that some of their comments are much bigger than this project. They're a bit more about the process for coordination of SIPs.
Yes, Scott Lannis for the applicant. I mean, in a sense, that actually doesn't go to the question of adverse effects on integrity. Potentially, because if it's simply a question of how to manage the SIP by way of regulatory authority, who's going to do it? One thing we may well want to explore with Natural England, if there's any way of separating that issue from the question of adverse effect on integrity, because if it is a pure question of management, there may be scope for agreement on adverse effect on integrity with the question of management to be debated separately. Because I think there's at least an argument at this stage to say that you could separate those for the purposes of the legal test and adverse effect on integrity.
Well, yeah, and if it is possible to decouple those two things, then
yes,
because the current status of discussions with their statement is that until there is agreement, then they can't advise no adverse effects, which again leaves us in a similar position to that we were discussing on ontology.
That's what we should do then.
Sean Leake. For the applicant, and we can certainly look to do that with Natural England. We've made it clear that all of the information that would be required in order to undertake that management is provided in the DML. That's there, secured. And they have certainty in the provision of the construction monitoring programme and so on. And the measures that have been identified within the site integrity plan for this project give certainty as well. There's an interaction potentially with the overwintering period for the project, for example. So it's quite a refined and closely defined issue with them. But we can certainly pick that up with them. It was a matter of the most recent discussion with them. The marine mammal lead was on the telephone and made it clear that this wasn't, that in broad terms the most recent iteration of the SIP was fine. There were no glaring issues with it. They recognised that we'd sought to address their queries with regards to timing and so on. So it's purely down to this matter of management and who undertakes that management fundamentally, which is beyond the applicant, as you say.
And you find yourselves at the forefront of the new process, so you get these tricky questions. The only other thing then in relation to marine mammals that I had on here is about the piling protocol, by which I'm talking about the request from Natural England and MMO to amend condition 16.3 of the DML to allow cessation of piling. I'm proposing that we actually deal with this under the DCO hearing tomorrow at ISH 8.9, because really it does mostly come down to that.
Thursday.
That's right.
You're wishing a day away. I think a number of people probably would.
Don't get away with it that lightly.
Endorse that.
I think I'm happy to park that one until then. Moving on then, item C, what I have here. My notes. So as far as our records show, we're still in the world of no agreement on adverse effects for the reef feature of the Thanet Coast SAC. But again, I think probably the best thing is to start off by asking you for an update on that.
Sean Leake, the applicant. So the cable exclusion zone was obviously
obviously implemented to avoid any direct impacts on those chalk reef features. That's been welcomed and accepted. There remains some consideration as to in combination effects with ongoing effectively harbour works at Ramsgate Harbour, so disposal works from harbour clearance and management. There's a question as to whether or not that actually falls in part of the baseline, that's an existing activity, and the likelihood of interaction. We do acknowledge, as Natural England raised themselves, that there was an increase in those works recently that have kind of raised the profile of their concerns with regards in combination effects of sedimentation. So increased suspended sediment and then deposition subsequently. The agreed position as it stands is that we have provided information at various deadlines. Natural England had most recently asked for that to be consolidated, if you will, into a single submission, and some form of illustration provided to show the overlap. That runs slightly contrary to evidence plan discussions, so we're sort of chasing our tails slightly as to the best method of providing meaningful illustrations rather than just sort of blunt buffers around the red line boundary. But we've been in communication with them today, and that's the main factor for this meeting that we're organising with them, really, is to, over the next week or so, we plan on providing some further information, this sort of illustration of potential zones of sedimentation that we will then present in person with them, and then that will be put before the examination as a as a clarification note, effectively, addressing their concerns. But that's it. So the project alone, there's been no particular concern raised. It does appear to be purely in combination with other, with this Ramsgate Harbour Works, and there are no other projects that would be ongoing at the time.
Now, in terms of the timing of that process, is that one of the reasons why you were expressing reservations over being in a position to document your position with Natural England by deadline 5?
Sean Leap, the applicant. Yes, sir. In part, because the ideal would be to have a meeting in advance of deadline 5 and submit to an agreed position. In lieu of that, I think we'll find ourselves in a position that the clarification note would need to be submitted at deadline 5, and then we'll have a meeting with Natural England shortly afterwards. But it's very much live. I've been trying to catch up on emails today to see where we can best fit a meeting in with them, and yesterday the same. But yes, in short.
Okay, thank you. Then I don't think there's anything else, unless anyone's no. I think we move on then to the intertidal salt marsh habitats.
Just before we do, far be it from me to suggest you slip deadlines, but equivalently, I think one of the things we need to be is very realistic about when certain pieces of work are capable of being done, and to commit to them being done and be very clear that there are not then going to be rebounding effects that flow down from them not having been done. Now, I'm just looking at deadline 6, because if you were in a position to frame the outcomes of your conversations with Natural England in inverted commas, final statements of common ground, which is the first bullet item of deliverable for deadline 6, my feeling would be that that might enable you to have a little bit more time to have a conversation.
Now I'm going to contradict you, because
that's fine.
I'm only thinking about the Rees.
Ah, of course, yes.
14th of May.
Of course. That was why we said it.
I would probably prefer, I don't say this out loud, but a late submission for deadline 5 that helped us, that we could take account of in formulating the Rees. Because I think otherwise that's...
Yeah. That's a very... Yes. I'm very grateful for that intervention.
Sorry to interrupt, Scott Lanthorpe. I mean, there is a deadline 5A.
There is now.
Yes.
And not 5B.
Would that work?
Yeah.
We could perhaps, so. if you're keen to stick to a deadline.
No, I mean, there is no particular magic here.
Right.
If it's late, it's late, and we have to consider it and exercise discretion and take it in. But yes, Ms. Powers is absolutely right. Because we need to form and publish the Rees, then it absolutely has to come in. And looking at, if it can't be achieved by deadline five, there is no particular virtue in producing it for deadline 5A other than neatness or tidiness.
Yeah.
Because it's not a thing we've asked for then, unless we amend the timetable again, which we would really prefer not to do for a whole range of reasons, then we're just going to have to exercise discretion. But yes, if you could particularly turn your mind to the 14th of May,
yes,
and we would need it, I think, sensibly a week prior to that at least in order to allow us to make sense of it.
Scott Lanner for the applicant. Sir, yes, entirely understand the point, and we understand the timing implications as far as the 14th of May are concerned. We work on that basis.
Yeah, I'm conscious we've pushed that back 1 week already, and I think in some ways it might be a virtue that we can feed some of this in, but as much as possible by deadline five on all of this. But if there is something that's dependent on a meeting with Natural England, that if you have to find an outline position at deadline five and then the supplementary information slightly afterwards, then I think that might be our preference.
Right. That's helpful, thank you very much.
Okay, should we move on to
Item
D? That's all right. A couple of items here on the salt marsh habitats, first being the salt marsh mitigation reinstatement and monitoring plan. Some of this is possibly straying into ISH 9 territory, in which case Mr. Smith will rein me in and tell me to put it there instead. But I first of all, I just wanted to see if there's any update on this, because again, we've had an updated version from yourselves at deadline 4 of this plan, a version of REBC, but we haven't yet had any written response comments through the timetable.
Sean Leake for the applicant. We do have a joint position with Natural England on this, which for ease I shall read out, that overall Natural England are content that the SMRMP has been successfully updated following Natural England's comments at deadline 3. As a result, Natural England agree the current document provides the scope to monitor, mitigate and reinstate the salt marsh within Pegwell Bay following construction in accordance with best practice and Natural England advice. However, Natural England still advise that horizontal directional drilling under the salt marsh still represents the best landfall option, as there is more certainty in the environmental outcome.
Okay.
So the plan is agreed and as final.
Okay, fantastic. Are there other parties with which you are seeking agreement on that version of the document? For example, I know we've got, and we've had a lot of comments from Kent Wildlife Trust on that.
There are other parties, in short. So Kent Wildlife Trust and Kent County Council as well. Kent County Council have since said that there's no salt marsh within their sort of land parcels of responsibility. So it does sit within the Kent Wildlife Trust Statement of Common Ground. It's a work in progress, I think that's fair to say.
If you actually wish to speak, please just come forward to the microphone, because otherwise it just won't go to the record and it... Okay.
It's a thumbs up for the
board. Thumbs up. It's been done. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I've got a question about where in the DCO this is secured. So at the moment, it's a DML condition for Transmission Act assets. I suppose the question in my mind is, our minds, is that the intertidal area is an area where we've got other jurisdictions stretching down to low water mark. However, as drafted, we have the salt marsh mitigation plan secured exclusively in a marine license and therefore enforceable by only the MMO. And I suppose the question in my mind is that appropriate? And what's been the reasoning for putting it there?
Can Can I briefly add to that as well, to highlight that part of the issue is a kind of dynamic environment issue and a complex environment issue, that the precise boundary between the MMO's jurisdiction and the terrestrial jurisdiction is highly complex in the salt marsh environment and is also amenable to, you know, change year on year, or even swifter timescales than that, as, you know, sediments move.
And this is different from some projects in the sense that it's a large intertidal area and it's a sensitive intertidal area. So I'm just conscious we need to get this right.
Scott Lanners for the applicant. We understand the point. I think the better thing to do, we go away and think about that. And it may be something we can update you on at the DCO hearing.
That would be actually very useful. I mean, one of the things that we have been kind of mulling over has essentially been how to ensure what one almost might refer to as a kind of cross maritime and terrestrial handshake between, you know, something that might be dealt with as a requirement and something that might be dealt with as a DML condition, so that no matter how the environment itself changes, the issue is not lost and it's covered.
Yeah. And that those who onshore may have an interest in discharging requirements or, you know, in enforcing in this area have the ability to do so. So yeah, that's fine to take it forward to ISH9, and I think in doing that, if I can ask, I'll throw this one and not ask for a response, but that monitoring plan also has a section, I think it's section 7.2, on reinstatement provisions, and whilst it's quite clear that the monitoring provisions are secured in DML, I'm not really clear that the reinstatement provisions are. And so if also that when you come along to talk about that on Thursday, you could be prepared to talk about that as well. So what the actions set out in section 7.2, are they secured? Do they need to be? And if so, does that mean changes to the DML? That would be really helpful.
Scott Lanners, the applicant. Yes, we'll take that on board, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One further point on this, which relates to the MMO statement of common ground, which again may be slightly out of date now, but there was a clear disagreement in terms of cable protection in the intertidal area. So I think we got no cable protection will be installed within the Sandwich Bay intertidal area. There's a sort of a clear statement of disagreement from the MMO there. Is the DCO committing to no cable protection in the intertidal area?
Sean Leake for the applicant. It should be within the schedule of mitigation, and it's secured throughout all of the environmental statement chapters.
Mm.
It's not currently on the face of the DCO, or perhaps more appropriately, the DMLs.
Mm.
It's a very firm commitment. I'd have no particular issue with it being on the face of the DMLs. There's obviously a bit of narrative toing and froing between the MMO and ourselves as to whether every last detail needs to be on the face of the DML or whether that can sit in a kind of a more readily auditable document behind it. But certainly that commitment is made clear and could be potentially within the DMLs as well.
Okay. On that point, actually, and allied to it, is the schedule of mitigation. I think it's stated in one of your submissions that it's a certified document, but as currently drafted, it's not included in the schedule, I think schedule 13, is it, of documents to be certified. So again, if the intention is to be included in that list, and it sounds like it will be relied upon, I mean, unless, of course, it forms part of the environmental statement, but one way or another, that schedule of mitigation seems to be quite important in terms of security.
Scott Lanners for the applicant. Yes, we'll take that away. I'm not sure we would regard it as as part of the ES now, so for the avoidance of any doubt, we'll take that on board. Malin, return to that, yes.
Thank you.
Okay,
and then just moving on, if we can, to the seasonal restriction point. It appears, the seasonal restriction appears to be a fairly important part of the embedded mitigation to the scheme. It's currently secured through just one DML condition, which doesn't specify on the basis of the DML what the actual dates are where the seasonal restriction applies. All it does is refer to the ES conclusions on this. Can you explain, firstly, why it was considered that not appropriate to put into the DCO, on the face of the DCO, what the details are of the seasonal restriction, given its importance?
Sean Leake, for the applicant. Yeah, perhaps slightly ironically, in draft going through and considering where best to secure these, we thought securing it as part of the construction monitoring program, so when that is submitted, all of that information is in a one-stop shop, would be helpful for the authorities and obviously whoever works on the project post-consent. Natural England have made clear that actually it's more auditable and helps their processes if it's just secured on the face of the DMLs.
Okay.
And we've discussed that internally over the last since Natural England made that request and have no issue with it, and it'll be reflected in the next iteration of the DCO.
Okay, fine. Great. We've talked about the overlapping jurisdictions, and I won't talk any more about that. I think there's, again, just for something to follow up in writing, perhaps I'll put it as an action point, but the schedule of mitigation points to a table 8.6, I think it is, of the ES as providing the assessment of the seasonal restriction, but when you go to that table, I don't think it's the right table, so I think that does need updating. So if you could clarify exactly where in the ES the seasonal restrictions have been assessed for the purposes of that condition 10.1c2, that would be very helpful.
Sean Leake for the applicant, absolutely. No problem.
Thank you. And then just to follow up on the sort of phase of operations and maintenance, because the schedule of mitigation states the same restriction would apply for operation and maintenance work. But it's hard to see from the drafting of the DML how that does actually secure that seasonal restriction for the operation and maintenance phase. So again, this is maybe something to say we'll pick up again on Thursday, but how is that seasonal restriction in the operations and maintenance stage secured in the DCO DML? Because basically where it sits, it's a pre-construction condition. So it's quite hard, and it doesn't talk specifically about O&M. It's very hard to sort of relate it to the current place that it sits in the DML.
Sean Leake for the applicant. I completely appreciate that, and I think by shifting it into a specific section of the DMLs, it could be very readily, you know, for all planned maintenance works and during the construction phase, the seasonal restriction to apply, which it would be a neat way of securing that, I think.
I think it would. I think it will help to address some of the concerns that we've been hearing about what's happened in previous projects, cables coming through there, and the certainty that people have, the comfort that they have that you're going to do what you say you're going to do. So I think having that as a discrete marine licence condition is the way forward. Thank you. As before, I will be following up. We will be following up on some of these points, anything that has applicability to others, the invisible parties around the table who may wish to comment, and that will go into our action points as well following this hearing, and we'll try to get those issued as soon as possible after this hearing. I'm going to move on then, I think, to our final part of the section of the hearing, so that's part E, and the Marine Conservation Zone.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Again, this is one of those ones where we've had a further clarification note on the MCZ from yourselves, but we haven't had an opportunity for any written response from any of the statutory advisors or key bodies who've shown an interest in this. So is there any update you can provide to us about the status of agreement?
Sean Leake for the applicant. Yes, Natural England have confirmed that they've been through the document, have some outstanding queries which have come across to us via email initially. Mm-hmm. And it's the Thanet Coast SAC and Goodwin Sands MCZ that will be picked up in those discussions. The main question, I think, has been ongoing consideration about this in combination effect with the Dover Port dredge works, which they've asked for some confirmation of overall areas, which we can provide. and the consideration of sound wave clearance and requiring dredge works is an additional additional factor that they would like to be clarified. So I think where we're going with this is that there's going to be an iteration, a reiteration of the MCZ clarification note. I haven't looked through the full detail of what's been requested, but my run through all looks eminently sensible from Natural England, and we should be able to address that in advance of deadline 5, certainly for submission at deadline 5. Again, it'd be good to be able to discuss that in person with them, but we're comfortable with those comments with regards cable protection and SAMO clearance and the pre and post monitoring. Mm. I can sort of hoover all that up as one. We haven't discussed much of this in detail, really. They've asked for further information on the monitoring. Mm. We're in a slightly chicken and egg position in that the trigger is if these works go on in that MCZ, then monitoring will be undertaken. Because there's an if, we don't know fully what that monitoring would look like beyond the commitment to undertake geophysical survey monitoring, drop-down video monitoring. Beyond that, the kind of the number of transects, if you like, of drop-down video and so on is a little uncertain. The last discussion that we had with Natural England, they appreciated that, but that's still something that we'll bottom out. And I think MMO in particular have sort of picked up Natural England's comments and said, yes, please, me too. I'd like a bit more information in the schedule of monitoring, so we need to address those in parallel.
Yeah. And so are you also talking to them about?
We are. Certainly for monitoring in general terms. We're close to agreement. I think they MMO appreciate that as well, certainly with regards to the MCZ and benthic monitoring. There is an ongoing sort of broader consideration out with the MCZ for MMO, which is clarification over long-term monitoring in association with turbid wakes. That the last update that we had from MMO was that they had asked for feedback from CFAS, and CFAS were due to provide that, and we haven't had full sight of that. I provided quite a detailed clarification for the MMO, essentially identifying that we're in a position where it's understood that there aren't any significant physical processes effect, but we're being asked to consider whether or not there might be an effect on the benthos. And there is a logical link there that if there's no impact on the seabed conditions, the physical environment is unlikely to be a significant effect on the benthic community that would be discernible through what would be what I would consider to be a proportionate survey methodology. So in much the same way as with the ornithological matters, you could end up with a survey that's got a huge number of data points in order to identify a very small, no doubt academically interesting question, but whether or not it reflects the potential significance associated with this project is something that we're still bottoming out with CFAS and MMO are going between the two.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned this question of if, and I'm just picking that one up because obviously this new reconstruction survey commitment has now entered the DML for Goodwin Sands, and that is introduced as in the event that certain works are carried out, certain works aren't defined, and I'm wondering what they are and what will be on the face of the DML or DCO to actually to clarify what that actually is. You know, when does this condition kick in?
Sean Leake for the applicant. I think that we will provide an update to the schedule of monitoring to just make it absolutely explicit. But the current evolving position for the DMLs is there will effectively be a monitoring condition that relates specifically to Goodwin Sands MCZ and identifies kind of three sub conditions within it, which relates to in the event of sound wave clearance, there would be combination of geophysical monitoring effectively, which has been utilised at another MCZ with an offshore wind farm, which is Walney Extension. It's an interpretation of the geophysical survey data to allow an understanding of whether there's been any change in sediment as a result of certain activity. With regard to cable protection, again, relates to geophysical survey, but in this sense, draws on drop-down video surveys to understand the sort of infilling of the gaps between the rocks that be used for cable protection and then any communities that live on top of them, the epifaunal community. And that, in essence, will form the thrust of it. But so we're going to put forward, I think, a specific MCZ-related monitoring condition, make it as clear as we possibly can.
Okay. Thank you. I think you touched on this point about cumulative effects with the Dover Harbour Board dredging project. Mm. I think it's a matter of public record that that marine licence application or decision is being High Court challenged. I just wondered if there's any implication of that for your cumulative assessment in terms of the timings or the potential for temporal overlap.
Sean Leake for the applicant. And we can only assess what's before us in terms of timing, so that does make that slightly challenging. Mm. We are aware of the judicial review on those works, or on that marine licence, as you say, and we will need to consider the likely timing of that and then the sort of knock-on effects for Thanet Extension in terms of the likelihood of some sort of temporal overlap. The likelihood of a spatial overlap is still very low in terms of the interaction between sediment plumes. The cumulative effect in terms of the benthic communities is something that we have sought to assess, and that does form part of the request for further information from Natural England, which is just to kind of quantify that in a single note. So it obviously sits in the Doverport marine licence application, obviously sits in Thanet Extension. They've asked for those two points to be pulled together in a clarification note, so it's as clear as possible. I suppose the point with regards to the potential delay and then any temporal overlap will be, rather than a habitat being part undergoing recovery, there may be a proportion of the overall habitat within that MCZ may be impacted at the same time. I mean, fundamentally, the impact associated with Thanet Extension is on sands and gravels and the community with it. We've already made a very firm commitment to avoid any of the sort of features of conservation importance with regards to the biogenic reefs, which I understand that the Doverport project has done as well. So we will be looking at recovery of sands and gravels. The information available on recovery of sands and gravels is that recovery is within 1 to 2 years. So there'll either be an overlap or a period of time where the southern part of the MCZ is undergoing some sort of recovery, whilst the northern part will be having physical disturbance of the sand and gravel. There is a difference in that we're not seeking to extract the material. It is a disturbance, a shifting from one place to another, which should increase the rate of recovery. The likelihood of recovery is not really a question. It's the rate of recovery that then becomes the question. If you're moving things from one side to another, the rate of recovery is ordinarily much faster. It's more akin to an abrasion rather than an outright removal and a clearing of the seabed.
Okay.
But that will all be made clear in this clarification note that's being drafted to pick up Natural England's particular concerns. Natural England's particular concerns clearly reflecting position of Goodwin Sands and it trying to ensure that same level of information is available.
Okay, so it sounds like at deadline 5, then we should be getting a further update to that clarification note.
Yes.
And hopefully that will be a relatively self-contained document, if possible, on the MCZ, and then possibly sounds like some pull-through to changes in the DML wording, potentially.
Certainly with regards to the monitoring. Yeah. Sorry, Sean, for the applicant. Certainly with regards to the monitoring, that would need to be adequately... Well, it needs to be secured in the DML. The DML... or update to it's not due at deadline 5, I don't think. But yes, that we're still in this slight quandary over timings with Natural England and the desire to get an agreed position, an agreed document submitted before you, rather than playing catch up sort of ping pong as we do on occasion. But absolutely before deadline five and that meeting with Natural England, we want to submit a note to them a week in advance of the meeting where possible, so they have adequate time to consider it.
Great, thank you.
If we then end up in a position thinking, well, actually we'll submit it at deadline five, then we shall do so.
Fine. And again, this will be an area that we follow up with some action points just for the other parties. I've only got one more item to cover, or one item to cover under F on our agenda. Is that okay?
Yes, and then I've possibly got a couple that fit on to the end of it. More from a perspective of finding somewhere to shoehorn them in than anything else, but...
That's fine.
Yes.
This one's not too detailed. This is just about the outline offshore operation and maintenance plan, which has come in as a B2 document, Rev2 document, at deadline four. And just kind of a note that you've got in there a traffic light system for items that may require additional marine licenses if works exceed things that were assessed in the ES. And I suppose it's just noting that the original version of this document that was submitted as part of the application, I think, had nothing in the amber and red column, and yet the version we've had submitted as a Rev B does actually identify quite a few amber items in there now. So elements of operation and maintenance work that may require further marine licenses. And I suppose I'm just interested to know, well, just explain why that's changed, really.
Sean Leake for the applicant. I think there was some, misinterpretation of the traffic light system as was originally submitted, that we have confidence in what has been assessed, that further marine licenses won't be required, versus acknowledging with with MMO in this case, that if those activities were to be exceeded, or if there was an understanding that actually some of those activities might need to be exceeded, they would require a further marine license. So it's really reflecting that the confidence. Do we have confidence in what we've assessed? Yes. But fundamentally, if for any reason they needed to be varied, of course we would need a marine license. So the update is just to effectively colour those cells in, acknowledging that.
And so in that case, why aren't all of the cells coloured amber?
I think it's because some of them aren't licensable activities.
Oh, okay.
I think from memory, so we've got some of the minor works with that we've discussed with MMO. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head. No apologies.
It may well be that that's the case, and that would explain it. Maybe it's a matter of presentation in that case, because what the table doesn't say is a marine, would a marine license be ordinarily required? Because the presented as it is, it looks as if there's some items that may exceed and some that may not.
I mean, that's some Sean Leake for the applicant. That's something that we can certainly take away.
I think that would be helpful.
And just so to clarify whether or not a marine license is required.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so that we understand what we have there as an amber, and if that's just the standard approach to everything that needs a marine license being flagged in there, or whether it's there are actually items in there that are licensable activities, but you put green against them, then why the difference in approach?
Yep. Certainly we can take
Thank
that
you.
Way.
I think then, yes.
Mr. Okay. Yeah. Right. There are just a couple of final items then that fit somewhat loosely here under item F, other environmental and construction matters, simply for lack of anywhere else on the agenda to put them. And they both relate to Crown Estate Interface matters that we note that they don't really sensibly fit into the compulsory acquisition hearing either. Now, we do note the presence of the Crown Estate, but also a request not to speak today, which we will endeavour to honour. But if it turns out that actually the simplest way to resolve this matter is to ask a question, then we would be grateful for possible forbearance on that final point. The first question that I wanted to check on was the progress of, to the extent that the applicant knows the answer to this question, any progress that the Crown Estate may have made on its plan level HRA in relation to this particular project and its implications for this project, and particularly an update on timing, because again, we want to be absolutely clear about when conclusions might emerge from that exercise relative both to the closure of our examination, but probably far more critically, the Secretary of State's decision.
Scott Linus for the applicant. We're not aware of any specific update since we last addressed this through the issue-specific hearings that's considered this before. Perhaps we could take that away as an action point. We could possibly speak to the Crown Estate in advance of Thursday, but we're not aware of any specific update beyond what we've mentioned to the panel already.
Okay. I mean, essentially here, what we are very desirous of ensuring that we do not do is to be unclear in any way to the Secretary of State about, A, the possible relevance of that process to the Secretary of State's deliberations, and B, its consequential implications in terms of timing.
Scott Lyons, the applicant. Perhaps, sir, if we take that away as an action point, we can provide a sort of position statement, as it were. Perhaps I...
You couldn't resist.
Well, I am grateful. We do now have the Crown Estate at a table with a microphone. And look, apologies for putting you on the spot, so to speak. But you know, it was a point that we really did want to try and not let drift past today without at least clarifying.
Stuart Curry for the Crown Estate. I think the written questions that came out on Thursday or Friday substantially cover these.
Okay.
Questions, and we were certainly going to address them in a written response, but the HRA process is on the indicative timeline that I outlined at the last oral response. It may or may not complete around the 11th of June. I think it's more likely to go beyond the 11th and finish just before it. I think the only reassuring thing we can say is that in terms of the agreement for lease, we have started discussions with the applicant and with other parties who are involved in the extensions process. We're saying that we're going to set a long stop date of the end of August for completion of the agreements for lease.
Okay.
So I think that would be within the subsequent three-month period where you have to write your report to the Secretary of State.
Now, of course,
certainly it'd be well before the end of the 12-month period.
Yeah, the dilemma will be that, of course, that we cannot take anything into account that arises during that point in time. So we will not be able to refer to it in the report. All we will be able to say is if we have reasonable confidence that it might be sufficiently concluded by the time the Secretary of State moves into decision making, that we recommend the Secretary of State to consult the Crown Estate and receive advice on its outcome before a decision is made. I guess as a marker, that is something that examining authorities prefer not to do unless they absolutely have to, simply because the legislative purpose for the Secretary of State's decision period was not to examine things, it was to make deliberations on
fully documented sets of considerations. So, yeah, we will not feel particularly content about that way forward. But if that's the only way that we can move on it, then obviously we will have to.
We'll try and give you an update before the 11th of June.
I'd be very grateful. Thank you. Now, the second and related question is a broader one, and it relates to the current position in relation to the Crown Estate's development of its Round 4 position. And there, we are conscious that there is now a lot of material available on the Crown Estate website, which has not been put into this examination and so is therefore not a formal consideration for us. We don't propose to make it such unless we were to find out that it was relevant to do so. But I guess the one point that does emerge from that material that we would just like to understand more than anything else is that there appears to be a proposition that both the Thames approaches and the Kent coast, which are regions 7 and 8 in the documentation, and I'm able, I believe, to get a link to a PowerPoint that's actually available on the Crown Estate website, sent across to yourselves by a member of the team here, and it is on, I believe, slide 71 of 81 in the PowerPoint link that will be sent to you, that is just a simple graphic showing the regional areas that are excluded from Round 4 and the regional areas that are not. Essentially, our simple question is that whether it be here and now or at another time, we will need to know through you from the Crown Estate whether there are any implications whatsoever for the Secretary of State's final decision on this application arising from the identification of regions 7 and 8 as excluded regions in that round.
I think this is one is probably best for me to take away and give you a written response. I mean, there are certain items that are in the public domain and certain things that may be coming along that we can elaborate and so on, but I'd rather take advice on what we can say at this point in time.
Yeah, no, I'm very grateful for that. Applicant, are you content that be taken away by the Crown Estate directly and responded to?
Scott Linus for the applicant, in a word, yes.
Yes, okay. Could we ask for that by deadline 5? I'm very grateful. Thank you very much. In which case, unless there's anything else emerging, Mr. Bradley, anything else? That probably brings us to the end, I suggest, of the material that we had originally estimated would require us to be sitting here until 1640. It's now 1626. We've recovered a little time. What I'm actually going to suggest, I'm conscious that maritime parties may be expecting not to reappear in this room until 5. So rather than being mean to them and telling them to abbreviate discussions that they might be having and to actually attend here sooner than we had originally announced, that we stick to the pre-announced time of 5 p.m. when we will resume. Ladies and gentlemen, see you then.